Welcome to Season 4 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication. Proudly sponsored by Allplay. If you're looking for a board game table, bag, playmat, or great board games, check them out at letsallplay.com.
Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 85, Mission to Planet Hex. Today, we are joined by Jim Fitzpatrick, the designer of Mission to Planet Hex, as well as Beyond Mission to Planet Hex, published by Move Rate 20 Games. Thanks for joining me.
Hello. Greetings, Space Cadets.
I mean, my mom does call me a Space Cadet, but I don't think it's for the same reason.
That's our byline. I think you either love it or you hate it. I'm not going to stop.
Nah, don't change. Oh, I love it. So, well, thank you for being on the show. And for anyone who doesn't already know you, would you mind trying to talk about like how you got into game design?
Sure. I am a computer programmer during the day, or a software developer, as they like to say. I've played select games. I like to throw myself into single games. So Magic the Gathering for decades and Dungeons and Dragons back to the 70s. A smattering of tabletop games. I've sort of put the cart before the horse in that I got into tabletop gaming by designing this tabletop game. So it's been a really interesting adventure, and it's been very cool to see the types of games that other people have invented. But, you know, mostly my games as a child, you know, tabletop gaming wasn't what it is today. So the traditional store-bought kind of things, you know, I remember Operation Monopoly, Stop Thief, you know, when electronic tabletop games started in. All kinds of variety. I always like to have lots of little pieces and something colorful and something that has to do with adventure.
Well, then bringing it over to adventure, what was the inspiration for Mission to Planet Hex?
I am like a broken record with my favorite things. It actually sprung out of my love for Doctor Who. I've been a Doctor Who fan since the 70s, the late 70s. And so I wanted to invent a game that involved, you know, adventuring through space. We eliminated the time element because it was like a lot. And I also didn't own the IP. And hexagons, the cards in the game are hexagons, is a very predominant repeating theme in Doctor Who. So I thought it all tied together nicely. So the game is sort of retro sci-fi. My head is more in the original Doctor Who than it is in the modern, although I love them both. The game is the vision of the future we had in the past. So it just sort of developed from there. I wrote this master document one morning and didn't take it too seriously until I brought the prototype to a convention and people kept playing it. So we'll see where this leads, and here we are.
For anyone who hasn't played the game, mind explaining how the setup goes and like what you're doing on your turns and all that good stuff?
Sure. The main component of the game, we have a deck of 120 hexagonal shaped cards. And you hold them in your hand, but you also build the map of the universe out of them. The goal of the game is you're trying to put six cards around a central card, which is your scorecard. It's called the mission file. And you do that by collecting what we call data cubes from planets on this board of planets and spaces that you create every time you play. And then you play other cards called events that will affect how the board goes or the game goes. And you're always trying to decide the cards in your hand, whether you want to use them to build the map or affect the game, or whether you just want to put them in your scorecard. And the idea is it's a race against the other players. Whenever I teach the game, I always say, welcome to the space race. The first person to complete their mission is the winner. You're taking three actions per turn, then drawing up to your hand of six cards and passing. And the actions can include things like building the map of the board or playing an event that affects the game, rolling and moving. Discarding and drawing a card is called a refresh action, and then putting a card into your scorecard is called uploading a hex card to your mission file. The idea is to find combos between cards on the board, in your hand, between the two, so that you can, you know, save a data here, save an action there, you know, skip a step and get to the end faster than the other people. And we also have a take that element included in the form of event cards that are called surprises. They have very stereotypical names, like one of them is called an alien attack, a climactic escape, a massive hull breach. You know, think of a sci-fi trope. And these are to slow down your opponents or divert them in some way or challenge them in some way. When we designed those, what we did is we thought we don't want to shut other players down because not being able to play is no fun. But to limit them in some way so that they're clever or they take risks. Because back to the theme of being a space cadet on your first space mission, you're trying to, I always say, see the movie, you know, cope with whatever materials you have at hand and whatever hazards are thrown your way. So we're constantly encouraging risk taking and small tableau building, because then once you, you know, if your plans come to fruition, that creates those wow moments in the game that everybody loves. But yeah, it's all about space adventure. And like I said, the replayability comes from, you build the board differently every time you play. And the deck is rather large, 120 cards. And as you mentioned, the Beyond expansion game adds another 88 cards to the game. So you can customize a deck or just use them all. It's 2 to 4 players. There's a lot of possibilities for fun, for sculpting your experience with this game as well.
Yeah, I remember meeting you at a lunch at like Origins. I think it was like right after the pandemic opened up. I'm pretty sure it was that one. But I didn't actually see your game until last year in the Tabletop Gamers Room at Gen Con. And I remember just doing kind of a glance at the table of what was going on. And I found it very interesting because I immediately, as a game designer, tend to look at graphics and try to guess what I think people are doing. And so
yes,
I like asked.
Thank you.
Because of your little like stop signs and your little like green go signs, I was like, so if your thing's on this, does it do with this? I found that very interesting how some of those cards activated. So if you wouldn't mind going into that, that'd be awesome.
Oh, sure. I always tell people iconography in the cards, it was added as a shorthand because as the universe of space and planets gets larger, you want to be able to act quickly and make your decisions quickly. And so the symbology, it accompanies the text of the card. You can read what all our cards do. But really, after a game or two, you will be used to how it goes. For example, like you were saying, there are several different types of planets and spaces on the board. And there are symbols that represent what they can do. Some are triggered if you choose to stop on them. Some are triggered if you choose to start your action on them. Some are triggered when you move through them. And those are fun because they combine with cards that will increase your move roll so that you can go through them several times and get the effect several times. Some have an effect when they come into play. And planets, as I said, you're trying to accumulate the currency of the game, which is data cubes, because you need 3 data for each upload to your scorecard. And the data comes from planets. Normally you just get 1, but if you go to a special planet, you might be able to get more under certain conditions, or you might be able to skip collecting data in order to trigger an interesting effect. And I'm a big stickler for theme and flavor. So for example, there's a planet called the Ancient Ruins of Malaire, and it says you can dump or turn over cards from your deck to the discard pile. So you turn over 6 of them and you look for objects. And if you find one, you can pay 1 data and put it into your scorecard or your mission file. And the theme there is it's the ancient ruins and objects are things. So you're basically digging through the ruins for artifacts. So I always try to put a little cute theme that matches the mechanic of the card so that you're actually doing what the planet or the space or the card says that you're doing. And there are all kinds of possibilities. There are 5 types of cards in the game. We have planets and space, as I mentioned. They make up the map. And then the event cards are aliens, dilemmas, and objects. So the people you meet, the things that you find, and the things that you do. And they all have epic names. And the reason for the stylized naming of the cards is that the win condition is, once you've completed your scorecard, if you're the winner, you get to insert the titles of the cards into the story. And so cards with silly names like Giant Robot Feet create some wacky stories. And that's just an unexpected 11th hour addition to the game that everybody loves. So there's a lot of fun to it, but I always say channel your inner middle schooler, because if you want to pick on people too or just be silly, you can do that too. You can play the game with strategy. We have cards for every type of player, the strategy player, the rules lawyer, the casual player, the chaotic player. I feel like everybody has a place at the table. And it's interesting to watch different numbers of people play. Like you said, the best way we advertise the game is getting people to play it. Because when you have all these colorful hexagons everywhere on this large table, on top of one of the play mats that we is not part of the game, but we also sell as an accessories, the colors and the action are often what draw people over and get them to ask questions like you did.
I thought it was really cool being able to have those questions answered for just like as a player. I feel like graphic design and just like good layout can really help. And it's nice that you attach theme into all the cards and the mechanics. It makes it more intuitive for new players, especially if you're not a gamer, to learn games better and easier.
Yeah, it's fun when people look at the cards too, and they either recognize something or they think they recognize something, because they're amused. There's some familiarity, which defuses stress over learning the rules. I love it when people say the game is medium, light to medium weight. So it has what I call a little bit of crunch. But once you get it, two rounds and you're in it to win it, really. Three actions, draw, pass. I see people, when I have demoed this hundreds of times all over the place, and I see people, and when their eyes light up because they get it and they're about to figure out a strategy, like now they're engaged, then I can step back and I just watch people play. I'm terrible though. Sometimes I don't step back when I should, and I'm helicopter parenting them, and they say, "We're good. We're good." I said, "Well, I'll be here if you have any questions." But the game has been play tested for many years. So we've tried to tighten it up and plug all the holes, and visiting conventions has been a great way to do that as well. You know, like you said, at Gen Con, we didn't play test there, but we play tested at PAX Unplugged and East, because I'm based in Massachusetts and so is Move Right 20 Games. Anything that's closer to us and that's easy to go to, I will keep going to. But I'm telling all my budding game designer friends, you know, find a crowd that's not your family and friends. I said, and you'll get really, really good advice. And the game community is so nice and so helpful. That's one of my favorite unexpected parts of this process as well.
I completely agree. Designers, super duper nice and typically willing to share advice and their feedback. And just knowing when you want to take said feedback is also important, because you don't want them to redesign your game, which I know some designers have a tendency to do. And I know I've also done it once or twice where I've accidentally done that.
Oh my gosh. And that was the first lesson. There's a wonderful organization in Boston called the Boston Game Makers Guild. And I brought this game to them. First people who were not my friends who saw the game. And I thought, they're going to be so impressed because this is the greatest game in the world. And they gave me very good feedback. But, you know, I didn't realize it was good feedback at the moment. I just left with my fifis hurt. And I thought, oh, I didn't know I was going to react this way. And I'm so emotional right now. Am I going to be able to pay attention to what they said? And that became also a process of learning how to listen. And if you couldn't listen right away, you know, give it 24 hours. Think about it again. Take good notes. And I realized how to deal with the process and what they were trying to say, and that they weren't saying it in a mean way. It's just, it was such an unexpected reception. It was different from the one that I expected. And you have to stay open and you have to listen, but you also have to stick to your guns. You know, I accepted a lot of critique, took a lot of stuff on board. And I can tell you when I was in places, who it was and where I was that brought the game to the next level because somebody gave me advice to help me fix a problem with the game. And I can also tell you when I put things aside and why I did, because I wanted to stick to my core concept. I think for any new game designer, that's the thing. Sort through all the advice you're given, throw out the bad stuff, and listen to the good stuff. And that's hard. That took a while to figure out how to do, but I hope I'm doing a decent job. Don't throw away your core concept because you get a lot, you know, because you respond to criticism, you know, and also don't ignore good advice. You know, somebody said, if one person says it, you can listen or not. But if five people say it, they might be onto something and maybe you should pay attention to them.
Yeah, there is definitely something I've changed in how I presented my games with playtesting is I tell everyone who the audience is. And this is mostly important for game designers, because game designers, depending on their tendencies, like I have a tendency towards stripping things down and making it more simplistic and more like mass friendly, where other people might add stuff. Making sure to frame the audience is important. So it's like, hey, this is going to be for this audience. Like someone who only plays Monopoly and party games would be totally different than someone whose favorite game is Twilight Imperium.
I think it's amazing. The two things you just said about yourself, I am the complete opposite, and they are both notes that I got at that first meeting. One of the notes was, okay, every card cannot contain the Encyclopedia Britannica. You know, short and sweet. Five cards do something similar, make a rule, and make all five of them adhere to the rule. Then you have to only explain one thing instead of five. Also, everything in the kitchen sink is not good. Pare it down. Pare down the things, you know, the mechanics of the game. Like I said, I can tell you there are five symbols that are activated on map hexes. I can't tell you how many there were. Actually, there were none when I started out. I just had the cards do whatever I wanted. So I tend to put in too much. Slimming down the text on the cards was a good idea. Also, slimming down the number of concepts and the number of cards in the deck. You know, when you have 150 cards and you're trying to promote them all to your audience, and it would really be a better idea to have 120 cards, it's like, you know, giving up your babies. But at the same time, now I can't even remember what those 30 cards were because we've had 120 for so long. And a practical upshot is I put these things aside, these concepts, and a bunch of them wandered back around and became the basis for some of the mechanics in the expansion. So I kind of got my cake and got to eat it too. And by the time they came back around, I was smart enough to change them so that they were better and they worked well with the existing game. Creating the original game and that design, it's been so interesting and so different from the expansion, because in the first one, we were creating the mechanics and the world and everything. And then in the second one, we were trying to build off of it. You're trying to create something new that isn't just a repeat of what you just did, which I think is incredibly boring. But also, you don't want the expansion to make the first game into a completely different game. I find that really irritating. Both of those scenarios. Keep repeating yourself and completely changing the game and having people go, well, what is this? I sat down to play Mission to Planet Hex, you know. So the challenges were fun. I actually liked the challenge of an expansion. One of the biggest difficulties was then you have to find people who know how to play the game in order to play test the expansion. So I was very aggressive trying to trap people and get them to try the expansion too.
Yeah, I feel like expansions kind of go into different mindsets of like some of them are just to add player count, some are to add just more material for like cards typically, or maybe it's like minis or whatever. So it's like more characters to play, and some it's, yeah, a completely new game that it's been added into.
Yeah, and you have to balance that because the expansion includes cards that are very simple to use. They're just amusing, but also cards that lean heavily into your new concepts. We were designing new cards that were cool, new cards with the new concepts that were cool, and then new cards that worked well with the new cards and the old cards. And on top of that, expanding all the lore, which is really fun. I mean, there's not a whole lot that you can really understand about the lore. You can just infer things because of the art and the names. For example, there's an empire of some sorts in the game. So you see the Imperial homeworld in the core set, and you see the Imperial peace ambassador, and you wonder why that person is wearing what they're wearing, and they look a certain way. And then in the expansion, the Empress herself appears, and there are all these references. There's the Snugger crime boss family. There's some kind of Space Cadet Academy, you know. And so we were expanding along a lot of different, you know, thematic lines, you know, mechanics and lore, and trying to make the art consistent. There was so much to this. Like I said, it was a huge surprise, because when you just say, I'm just going to make up a game, you don't know what you're getting yourself into. And that's not a negative thing. Like I said, it's really been fun living in this universe. So much so that, I mean, you know, I get ideas all the time. I could sort of understand. It's a distant cousin to collectible card games. Like I said, I have some Magic background. And when you create this world, we get ideas all the time. For example, I have ideas for small expansions. And we have another large set, which may or may not come to fruition. But it sort of has to do with like the frontiers of the wild, you know, the outlands of space, like the Wild Wild West. And it involves manipulating the map. It's kind of like driving through an asteroid field. I said it's sort of based on like the asteroid field in The Empire Strikes Back, or what's the other one? Attack of the Clones. And again, it's all tied to the core concepts. It just adds a spin, which adds new strategies. Like I said, we don't want to repeat ourselves, but we want all the cards to work together. So that people say, yes, this is Mission to Planet Hex, but it is not the same as what I played. It adds a new dimension, you know, and that may or may not happen. There's nothing wrong with coming up with ideas that then, you know, don't get put down on paper, but you're always hopeful, or at least that's my opinion.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the amount of ideas I come up with, I'm lucky if I write it down in a notebook, whether
yeah, they're just like shooting out my ears.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like figuring out what to focus on and move forward with is important. Like for this game, what in particular made it the game you wanted to publish with Move Rate 20?
It had a first version that I made myself. Honestly, the playtesting version, I'm sure you're familiar with this process, printing the cards out on cardstock, cutting them out and playing them. And then we discovered the Game Crafter, which brought it to the next level. And the original game, and there are versions, there's a couple hundred copies of it out in the world somewhere. All the art's made by me on MS Paint, so it's hilarious. It looks a little bit like an old 70s video game. But conceptually, I got to have all this freedom to make it what I wanted because, you know, it was so easy when I was just doing it all myself. I could get instant results, so I could make changes instantly. I had a lot of friends who helped me to copy it. So it was easy to sort of take the clay and make it into something that was very like a finished product before I had the finished product, which may be a weird way to do this. I don't know, because it's my first game. But I just, like I said, my life has been steeped in sci-fi and fantasy. And, you know, there are loving tributes in this game to all of my favorites, not only Doctor Who, the original Star Trek, Jetsons, all the old 50s sci-fi movies. This was all bubbling up in my head, inspiring me to do this. The name of the game, and if you look at the cover of the box, the style of the rocket ship, it's very much in style with those 50s movies. Think Forbidden Planet, When Worlds Collide, Destination Moon, War of the Worlds, you know, 1953, was it? So that was what was driving me forward, is I wanted to create this space cadet experience and have these cool worlds, these exotic places to visit. And all those familiar things. We have robots and ray guns and just lots of silliness. I originally had more sort of toilet humor in it, but I wasn't sure how that would go over. So we just made silly. And I love alliteration, for example. We lean very heavily into that in the expansion. We have the Parliament of Pangalactic Politicians. I'm a fan of Dickens, and you know, I always say you have to read it fast in order for it to sound right, and you can't make a mistake and you can't paraphrase, because the language is a huge part of it. So you sort of, and that's also amusing if you're trying to get through that mouthful of consonants while you're playing. I love teaching the game and having people draw their hand and look at their hand, and the first thing they do is kind of chuckle. I get a big kick out of that. I said, well, I hope you like the game too, you know, but we're on the right track at this point. I just have always loved sci-fi, and part of that, we talked earlier about being in queer spaces. Growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, as a gay man, there was that, I'm a recovering shy person, I like to say, and you'd never know it now because now I'm the carnival barker of the conventions, but it was, you know, a little bit scary, and it was a little safe to stay at home and in a fantasy world. I had Star Wars toys. I had these great sci-fi toys called the Micronauts that were originally from Japan. And, you know, I isolated myself in these worlds that were so important to me up to a certain age. And then, you know, it just sort of intrinsically knew that, not that I had to move past that. I don't think you move past it. I think you take everything with you. But the idea that, you know, being home alone in my dark room was not necessarily good for me, but that all of these things were something that I could take with me. And then you discover there's a whole world of people who like this stuff just like you do. And it actually facilitates being less shy and reaching out to people. One of the nicest things about a game convention is you go there, and even if you don't know anyone, you automatically have something in common with everyone. And all you have to do is open your mouth and you can start a conversation and make a friend. I think that's great.
It's so crazy how much I relate to everything you just said, except for me, it was very much comic books and superheroes. Like, I used to draw my own superheroes.
Yes. Oh, well, I had some of that too.
Yep. It's funny because so much of, yeah, when I was younger, I would just like sit on the couch and doodle out my superheroes and live in my own little world and like force my friends to play my Team Hero board game that I created.
And it made me so happy and it was very safe and yep. It was very, you know, it was a comfort. It was like comfort food. I was so into the Avengers. I said when Doctor Who, the modern series, became so popular and the Avengers became so popular, I said, you know, the weirdest thing is I have been explaining to people for decades who the Avengers were and what Doctor Who was. And the fact that I don't have to do that anymore is still weirding me out.
I know. We're kind of cool now. I used to get made fun of for being a nerd. It's so weird.
Yeah. Oh, nerdism, nerdery, whatever you want to call it, the nerd culture. It is so changed. You know, when did we get cool? But I'll take it.
Yeah, I'm not taking it back. Like, this is, I'm cool now. We're going to let it go.
I love my nerd friends. I love my nerd spaces. And I mean, talking of those connections, for example, at TotalCon this past weekend, this man sat down with his son and he looks at the table and he looks at one of the planets and he goes, oh, that's from Doctor Who, isn't it? And I just said, in 8 years of playing this game, no one has ever gotten that reference. Or if they have, they haven't told me about it. And we had this connection. And then the son was sort of looking at us, rolling his eyes, going, third wheel, third wheel. We're here to play a game. But it was delightful because, like I said, all of a sudden, I'd never laid eyes on this person in my life. But he's saying, yeah, that's from 1978. And I just get a big kick out of that because it just eases that tension. You know, when you walk up to a game that you signed up for at a convention and you don't know anyone and you say to yourself, how's this going to go? And I like to diffuse that. From the get-go, I say I'm a big presence. I'm 6 foot tall, 225 pounds. I want to diffuse that and say I'm friendly. The game is friendly. There's no compulsion to stay and play for any length of time. I love it when somebody says, "I think I've seen everything I need to see." Great, love it or hate it. If you've been to a giant convention, I feel like you do need to keep moving along, otherwise you're going to miss things. I figure if people want to spend more than 20 minutes at my booth, they should either get the game out of the game library and play it in free play or buy a copy themselves, because you're obviously having a good time. But don't miss everybody else too. You know, it's a give and take. I feel like people feel like there's never enough time to play their games, and it feels like that sometimes. But there's also lots of opportunity to play games. So I feel like a convention is sort of like going through and just sort of like, have you seen the people who go through and they snap pictures of the booths that interest them? And then they come around again and they stop for a few minutes. And then the next day they stop for a long time at like the top five. That's very much would be my process. Just knowing that I've seen it and made my choices.
100% agree. I think of it as like window shopping, because really you don't have enough time to play all the games. Maybe you get to play like two or three.
And going to these conventions over and over, you can spot the first timers and they've got that overwhelmed look, and you know, or I've brought them with me, you know, and I say, take a deep breath and just stroll around. Take that burden off of your shoulders and go look at games, but go look at indie games like ours, because there's nothing wrong with big company games, but if you can find them in other spaces, look for the things you can't find anywhere else. That's also like my motivation. I want to see who's doing what in the furthest corners, you know, of the convention. I've met some cool people that way.
Yeah, no, I always take like 30 minutes to go walk the entire floor. And I also go like to every convention that Tabletop Gamers is at, and I go get my like gamer ribbon and stuff. Because like how you mentioned just like connecting with people instantly, it wasn't until I got into gaming that I started to feel more myself, because I found people like me. I found other people that were gay, other people that were like nerdy, that liked to travel. And it was just this instant connection, which I never really felt before in my life. And it's like hard to describe to people who haven't felt something like that.
Full of examples. I've been to all the PAX Unplugged, and I remember the first one, bringing my prototype, sitting in the free play, hoping someone would notice me, hoping someone would play, you know. And now you flash forward to this past fall, the load-in was actually on my birthday. And I had to order a table. So I went and ordered the table, went back up to the car, came back in. And the table was set up, and my friends from another booth had put birthday balloons on it. And in a space of 5 minutes, I said, your timing's amazing. And then just people kept coming up. And I had a new friend with me helping me out. And he was just like, you know everybody. And I said, it took a while, but I'm starting to feel like I do. People stopping by to ask about the game, mention the game, talk to me, meet me for the first time because we're virtual friends, share with me stories outside the space. For example, I had a trans friend who I had not seen since their transition and stopped by to say, I'm still here, you know, I'm still around. And just probably sort of to look for that affirmation, you know, like we all do when we all go through our processes. And I was touched. I thought that was wonderful. And I just said, looking forward to seeing you more. So many different kinds of people come to our booth too. And that makes me feel good because I think it makes me feel like our booth is a place where they feel like they can come. You know, even though we don't blatantly say, you know, we're this kind of space or that kind of space, I think we're just trying to project that, you know, in general. And we do get everyone in the kitchen sink, you know, everyone from every walk of life. And we try to stay open because it's not only good for business, but I mean, why be a jerk? All the political stuff that's going on now, my husband was confronted by people at work about, I don't know what the topic was. And rather than engage them, his response was one of my favorites ever. He said, well, why not just be nice? And I said, I'm going to put that on a t-shirt. Is it so hard to be a courteous person, to be a kind person or a polite person? Cut somebody some slack, give them a break, or maybe let them win. I have a hard time with that, though. Not because I like to win, but because I like to aggressively show people how the game works. So I'm like, I'm not really going after you. I'm just giving you the tools to go after your friends.
As far as the game goes, like how long did it take from your initial inspiration to having the game published and like going to cons and stuff with it?
Early 2016, like I said, I was inspired one afternoon to write out this master document, and I still have it. Some of the cards have never changed. Some have changed completely. I went to Boston Fig the fall of 2016, and that was the place where I told you people played it for the first time. I went to my first convention outside of Massachusetts in 2017, and that with that copy I told you with all my art and all that stuff, and we made the transition to we're going to hire an artist, we're going to go pro, I think around the end of 2019. And because I'm a genius and didn't know what was coming, our Kickstarter year was 2020. So I made this video saying, look for us at all these conventions in 2020. And we actually made it to 5. We were in the PAX South showcase at the beginning of the year, which is why I think we were funded. And that was the last PAX South in 2020. And it was wonderful. I really wish I could have gone back. But we have an online version as a consequence of that, because all the conventions in 2020 were virtual. And I pushed it. I said, I can't wait any longer. This has got to, you know, we have to do this or not do this. And it worked. So that was successful. The game, we had it in hand by 2021. And that's when conventions were opening back up again. It's been tough because it's been tough to judge how well the game sells because the conventions were not normal, you know, in terms of attendance, who was there, what was going on. And so I've watched the recovery process of PAX East, PAX Unplugged, and Gen Con as well. Like Gen Con this past year was overwhelming. And from what I hear now, their hotels have opened this week and everybody's in a bad mood because it's a mob scene and people are not able to get a hotel near the place. And so that changes the dynamic. It makes me feel less bad about whether we did or didn't do good business at conventions because now we're watching this re-blossoming process. You know, PAX East is back to, they just sold out Saturday. So we're watching in a very interested way how the landscape is changing. And we continue to do better and better every time we go back. And I think that's part of that process. Like I was saying, once you're established and then people want to see, well, what do you have that's new? Or they've heard about you, so they want to try it. I've had people who've bought it, who come to the booth and say, I just want you to show me, you know, I want to hear it from, you know, the horse's mouth, the creator, which sure, I'm always happy to interact with people. I answer questions about the game and the game rules on social media. Someone will message me because they're playing in the middle of the night. And sometimes I'm up in the middle of the night. But yeah, so about, you know, 4 years for the current version of the game.
Okay. And then as far as like your favorite and least favorite part of that experience of specifically the design journey, not necessarily manufacturing, what would you say they were?
It was a rocky road. First of all, I wish I'd known sooner that I was going to do it seriously, because I probably would have cut a year off of having that first version and gone right to it. But I'm super cautious. It's just in my nature. And it takes a while sometimes to hit me over the head and go, oh, this is really working. You should take this more seriously and get it into stores. And the other thing was, one of the reasons it was playtested so thoroughly is right in the middle of the process, my dad passed away in 2017. So my sisters and I had to handle his estate. And it was, that was also very time consuming. And I was the executor. And so I couldn't really do anything else besides play the game. You know, the only thing that was easy to do was just go to a convention and play the game. So I didn't have to set up anything. I didn't have to deal with any business. So I went kind of an extra year and a bit playing the game rather than doing the business and finding the manufacturer and all that stuff, because I just didn't want to be totally overwhelmed. So that was good for the game because we worked out those final kinks, but it made the process even longer. I had originally envisioned 3 to 5 years, and now, like I said, here we are in year 8. But we always have something new. Like the expansion is still new this year at a lot of conventions because we had it in hand last April. So we got a couple months to go before everyone has seen it. So, you know, and I have other ideas. Every experience, I put down little notes about what it would be really neat if you did this next year or added this thing or whatever. It's hard to just quickly create a thing like a game or an expansion too. And we'd like to create other games, but then there are challenges from, you know, COVID and stuff with our members and their families and how their lives are, go. So there's a lot of limiting factors. And I'm also not as young and spry as some. I was kidding about being senior citizen earlier, but I'm over 55. So that makes a difference.
Yeah, I feel like I've definitely gotten the perks of being young, single, and able to do whatever I want. It's helped me be able to design probably more games than I should work on at a time.
Oh, yeah. And people always talking to me, well, when you do your next game? And I said, oh, honey, I don't know. But I'll save your advice for later. We'll see what happens. Because every year you go, it takes longer. Everything feels heavier.
And speaking of advice, what would be one piece of advice you give to anyone trying to design a game like yours?
Two things. One, when people say, I have an idea for a game, should I design a game? I say, yes! Well, who's it going to hurt? Why shouldn't it be you? Yes. The worst thing that can happen is you'll be exactly the same as now. You don't have a game that works. But if you do have a game that works, wouldn't it be cool to have people saying that they play your game and they love your game? That would be cool. The other thing is to listen but stick to your guns. Like I was talking to you about earlier, know what your concept is, but don't be afraid to listen to people who advise you to change it. But like I said, also stick to your guns. Don't just change everything. If you change everything into another game, do you have two games now? You know, I know what it is that you want to do. And that goes hand in hand with, for example, I felt like I had to decide when we published if I was going to give the game away or if we wanted to self-publish, and to know that, because that will define your path as well. If you don't care what people do with your game and you just want it published and you want to give it away, that's your path. And you have to do a certain list of things. I knew that I wanted to self-publish. So that was another list of things. If you're not sure, that will, I think you might take some wrong steps before you figure it out or whatever. So kind of figure out what you want your end game to be, and then you'll be all set.
I like that. They are very different, and I get asked a lot on what's better, and I think neither are better. Both are different, and everyone, it's going to have be something that's different.
And they're variations on the theme.
Yeah. Well, then, for my last question of the podcast, I'd love to know, what would be a game that you wish you had been the designer of?
Well, there's so many ways to answer that question. I would say, not to give them a plug because they don't need it, but I was going to say Fire Tower by Runaway Parade Games, because they're doing so well. We actually started at the Boston Fig Showcase through the curtain with each other. I think their success is so great and their game is so simple and fun. I watch people play it and, you know, it's hard to look from the outside at my own game. I can occasionally when I watch people play it and I'm not playing, but usually I'm there in the context if I'm teaching it or I'm playing it to teach it. And if I could, I might go back and, you know, simplify some things because, like you were saying, good and simple, you know, that is good for players. one of the things that I was told when I first brought my game in front of game designers was, who's the audience? You know, I said, it's a family game. They said, first, it's not a family game. Young kids can't play this. And I was like, oh, okay. I sort of was thinking, you know, family game because I wanted to invite everyone. But you have to understand who your audience is. And I have a huge theater background too. So know your audience is a big part of that. But this spreads over to, we actually did start to design a second game. It was called Ruthless Old Prospectors. And it's about being a cheat and stealing prospector who wants to get the deed back to town. So you all camp out in the middle of the mine and then you all try to escape at night and you throw, you cause rock slides and use a pickaxe to get through walls and throw dynamite. And it's kind of funny, but it's really, really simple. And we have these design goals that are completely the opposite of Mission to Planet Hex. No dice, less art, fewer rules, something basic but fun. And we actually won the best game in progress at Boston Festival of Indie Games in 2019 before they stopped doing live events. But I admire the simplicity of it, the fact that people enjoy it so much, because I look at that and I say, that was exactly what we were going for, or what we are going for. I don't want to say were, because it's like the process is never over. It's always ongoing. When I do see people enjoying the game and getting satisfaction out of it, then that's when I get satisfaction as well. So I just feel a real affinity with them because we've sort of matched each other on so many levels. And we still see them all the time everywhere. Like I said, they're very successful and it makes me so happy because we're all part of that community and I feel like maybe I helped them. I know they certainly helped me. So I often just think about them and associate them with this whole experience.
That's really cool. I love both of them. They were on my first season of this podcast, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, they get around.
They do. Yeah. And I mean, I'm also on the East Coast, so we knock into each other pretty frequently. But it's kind of cool, like, thinking of each other in almost like the same design class, like in school. You all kind of came up together and you all are succeeding in different ways, but still, it's fun to, like, do that. I know I feel the same way with a lot of people I started designing with at the same time at, like, in Chicago or when the Chicago group went online. So I think that's great. That's awesome. I'm glad you're still in connection with them.
The community has been such a surprise and such a gift. That's another thing I tell new designers. Don't worry. Wherever you go, you're going to find yourself supported. You're going to be very pleasantly surprised.
Very true. And for everyone who's listened to this episode, thank you for joining us for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 85, Mission to Planet Hex. And thanks again, Jim, for being on the show. For anyone trying to find you in the game, where should they find you?
The best place that you can locate us is on our Facebook page. Not only is that where I do the majority of our operations, and you can look for the game page or the company MoveRate 20 Games. It's essentially the same. You'll find them, you'll find me. And then we're spread across social media, but the Facebook will point you to every place that you want to be. If you want to buy it, if you want to talk to me, if you want to read about the game before you play it, it's all there.
Are there any conventions you're going to?
Yes, we're about to go to PAX East, which is right next to home. We are already booked for Gen Con and PAX Unplugged, and I'm going to try out the Vermont Sci-Fi Expo this year, which is exciting because our fabulous artist Marc Gagné is also going to be there. And we may or may not be sharing some space, which we haven't done yet. So we'll see about that. But I love a sci-fi based con because that's what we are and that's what we do.
Very cool. I'm your host, Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find me on social media, just look for Token Gamer, G-A-Y-M-E-R, on Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky. I will be at basically every major convention this year, so you'll see me at the Wise Wizard booth.
Well, I look forward to seeing you.
Yeah, right?
Come on by. We'll give you a token something.
Sounds good. I'm down.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out NoDirectionPodcast.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or gaming table, check out AllPlay at Let'sAllPlay.com. Join us next time.